I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
I don't play football. I would never dream of playing football. I ain't want anybody to hit me. But I take this mentality with me everywhere I go. When I give speeches, I tell people all the time, I'm brilliant because I know I'm not. I'm never satisfied. I learn from people who are brilliant and I steal knowledge from them. The same is applicable to you. If you see somebody that's better than you, if you look in your mind's eye and you know that somebody has something that you don't, why not ask yourself why? Why not ask yourself, how can you get it? Who told you that they get to have a monopoly on greatness? You living, you're breathing, you're eating, you're working, how come you can't get it? You gotta ask yourself these questions. And that doesn't mean the answer will always be yes. It doesn't mean the answer is always going to be in an affirmative for you. But what it does mean is the fact that you ask yourself that question means that you are looking for every excuse, every little nugget that you can find, that you can muster to maximize your potential.
That, of course, was Stephen A. Smith, somebody that is universally loved and embraced by pretty much the entire sporting community. No, that's not what Stephen A. Smith is. But that is why Paul Gallant, as you join me on the Deceptively Fast podcast, I actually felt good about humanity that I saw people grudgingly give Stephen A. Smith credit for giving a pretty moving and motivational speech. Stephen A. Smith gets on my nerves at times, many of the times, almost all of the times, but he's a very successful person. And I thought that was good advice for a young Syracuse football team that is destined to win at least 3 football games this year.
Hey, they might even get 5 this year.
What is the over-under on Syracuse?
It's probably
right now?
4. They're 4-8 every year. Here's the thing. They actually have a good quarterback, but he is a quarterback that can't throw. I know that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Not as much in college football.
He's
it
tough.
Doesn't matter as much.
His name's Eric Dungy. He's a tough motherfucker. Like, the guy, I feel he's had 7 or 8 concussions or so in his career. Very fun to watch. They will
be
watchable.
But he's old school. He encourages the trainers to just ignore it.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Yeah, wink, wink. Are you winking because you're trying to tell me something, or are you winking because he had a concussion?
I don't know.
Who knows? Yeah.
Right. He is likable. They're a likable team. They will play well. They will compete, but they will lose the majority of their games.
So Stephen A. Smith talks to these guys. I don't know exactly how he ended up in front of them, if like he was up there doing something
probably
anyway.
Probably was passing through Newhouse for some sort of speaking opportunity for students because school has started up there. So I imagine he stopped by Newhouse, gave some sort of pep talk, and Syracuse University probably said to themselves, well, you know what? Let's bring him out to the football team.
Yeah, he didn't use the word in there, but jealousy is really what you're addressing. When you look at successful people, particularly – I think it's easy to look at people that are older than you and successful and say, oh, of course, I'll try to emulate them. When you see people that are your same age that have more success than you, it's a really, really hard thing to do to just set aside your ego and say, okay, you know what? They're doing something differently than me. Maybe it's that his daddy helped him out, but like, okay, who can be my mentor and help me out in a similar way or whatever.
You should always be willing to ask questions of people that are older than you. And even if you're asking them just for the sake of asking them, it's doing stuff like that. You might get insight you didn't expect. And when I first came into this industry, I did not really think anything of myself. And they were, when I first joined Sports Radio 610, telling me to do whatever the hell they wanted. And I was like, yeah, sure. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, yes. And that approach has worked to this point. I look at people today and I wonder how many people still have that kind of patience. It seems that the younger generation, maybe this is something that's a myth, but that they want to move up the ranks a lot quicker than is actually possible. And the frustration with the lack of movement, they decide to just, as Paul Rudd says in Forgetting Sarah Marshall's, fuck the lemons and bail.
Yeah. Well, but it's tough because it's really low unemployment right now, and there are a lot of opportunities out there. And job hopping doesn't have the stigma attached to it that it used to.
Right.
So I say it's tough, but it's easier for them in some respects to just leap onto another job. And maybe for some guys and for some young kids, maybe that is the actual best measure for, or best tone for them. I guess it's just a matter of, like, are you doing it because it is actually a better opportunity, or are you doing it because somebody wasn't giving you everything right away?
Yeah, it's tough. I think it varies person to person. And, I mean, to have that kind of feeling is natural. I think you should almost always have that feeling. I know I had that feeling not that long ago.
Yeah.
With certain people, some of which were older than me, some of which were not older than me, where I looked at them and I was like, why do I not have this? Yeah. What am I not doing that I don't have this? And the problem is, I think for a lot of people, it sort of festers and you don't actually do what you're supposed to do, which is anything, literally anything, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, instead of just fuming about it.
Do something.
And just entering that spiral of self-doubt and blaming others and everything. I think a lot of people, too, really don't understand and realize, like, that you have to stop with the notion that everything's a meritocracy. Because it just flat out isn't.
It's not. You're right.
If you're working in a company, or even if you're independent, so much of it is about, do people enjoy working with you? Are you there when the opportunity presents itself? And that's where I think where so much is made of working at home or working independently or working out of a coffee shop these days. If you work in a place that has an office, there's a lot to be said for just being around the office. And that, like, it's happened with me just with sales opportunities here. At our radio station, we have 5 different radio stations here. I've had salespeople from the Spanish-speaking station think to use me in a campaign just because I was around, you know, because it was 3 in the afternoon on a Friday, and they're like, "Hey, it's Seth. Hey, Gringo, you'll do," and it works that way.
And learning from the veteran of the sales opportunities, that is something that I need to do instead of being bitter about not getting them.
Just go out and just actually
see. Just gave me advice right now.
The other thing that Stephen A. Smith does here. Very powerful and yet underutilized. And I think it's partly because so many of us listen to podcasts at 2x speed now. The pregnant pause. Very good with the pregnant pause. Sometimes it feels when you're speaking like a pregnant pause is lasting 5-10 seconds, but it's not.
Doing a solo radio show?
Yeah. Oh, you learn the pregnant pause, don't you? You learn the value.
So some people used to give me shit for it because I after a while, they would really drag on. Now, for some moments, it was emphasis.
Yeah.
But for other moments, it was, I don't remember what I was talking about. Here we are.
But that's the beauty of the pregnant pause. If you routinely use them, then people think the exact opposite of what's actually happening.
Right.
You don't know what you're talking about, but the people are thinking, like, oh, he's about to say something big. But then I guess if you're stuck in that moment, then you really got to come up
with
something.
I feel like I gave a lot of my listeners blue balls then. If that's what they were waiting for, something big. I didn't take them to the Happy Town any of those times.
Now, that one thing, one quick tangent, that reminds me. The way that radio ratings are measured now, it's kind of technical. And I guess we're not supposed to talk about it overly, but this is all public information.
Yeah.
There are people meters that people wear, and they detect a certain frequency in the music or the radio station that you're listening to. And then it's like a Nielsen box with television. They just extrapolate all that data out and figure out roughly how many people are listening. But smooth jazz has taken a huge hit because they can't transmit as strong a people meter rating over smooth jazz without hurting the quality of the music.
Interesting.
So the smooth jazz, so there are people out there that want to listen to smooth jazz, except it doesn't show up in the ratings, so advertisers don't want to spend as much money on it. So smooth jazz stations are dying by the dozens, scads of them.
As someone who, my dad, when I was growing up with my dad, Gary, he was someone who loved to find ways to annoy me. And this is sort of what I've become, a little bit of a troll, because my dad was. One of the things that he used to do was change the channel from whatever I was watching to the Weather Channel. My dad loves jazz. Weather Channel's always playing jazz music on in the background.
Oh, so you just put the Weather Channel on and
just jazz nonstop. And then while in the car as well, always switch the radio to jazz. So if there's less jazz than the smooth jazz in the world, it's not that I have a problem with smooth jazz. It's just that my dad, that was one of the few musical experiments that he tried to pull on me to make me like it that really failed colossally.
I'm going to start a foundation to rescue the smooth jazz. Monday Night Football last night, my quick takeaway would be this. Andrew Luck looks like he might be on his way back, but he didn't really do anything all that impressive. He had some really, really bad throws. And more than anything, his offensive line, even though it might be slightly improved, is still just like a dagger dangling above his face, and I'm worried that he's going to die. Joe Flacco, I thought, looked really good. He's healthy. He's appropriately motivated by Lamar Jackson, who's underneath him. If I were a Ravens fan, what I'd be worried about is this. Joe Flacco seems to be responding to the competition really well. Last night we learned that Lamar Jackson is likely nowhere close to being ready to start an NFL game. He was heaving balls off into the first row of the stands. It just looked awful. Does Joe Flacco all of a sudden get fat and lazy?
I don't think so. I think Flacco realizes that his legacy at this point has become he sucks. I think he hears this outside noise, and he's obviously acting like he doesn't care about it. But, I mean, Jalen Ramsey, that you hear that from a guy like him, and you're like, damn it, man, it's been five years since I had four perfect games in a row.
Do you think his legacy is that he sucks, or at least like the book on him now?
Yeah, right, I mean, yeah. He had four incredible games in a row in the playoffs, and before that and after that, he really never looked like that at all. But they did a really good job, Baltimore, this offseason of overhauling the receiver core. I mean, Rashad Perriman, they were trying to make that work for the longest time, and I don't even know if he makes the team this year. Now you bring in Willie Snead, you bring in Michael Crabtree, and you bring in a guy I know you like. I like him because I've had him on my fantasy team like for 3 years in a row, even though he always gets hurt because I love how fast the guy is. You have John Brown, who's like the perfect Joe Flacco receiver because he's just fast as shit, and he can run like 40 yards straight down the field, T.Y. Hilton-esque.
John Brown – both Mike Meltzer and I have an emotional attachment to because he first showed up when he was a rookie with Arizona, and in Bill O'Brien's first game as head coach of the Texans in a preseason game just got torched by John Brown.
Yeah, he was really good.
And so it's almost in like this weird, you know, that kind of weird nostalgia you have for a time when you were depressed. Do you ever get that? You're kind of like, you think back on a time when you were depressed and somehow you actually feel nostalgia for it. That's how I feel about John Brown, because I went into a state of football nihilism after the game in which the Texans just got bludgeoned by the Arizona Cardinals by John Brown specifically, to where I felt like I'm going to quit my job. I can't go through – we just came off a 2-14 season. I can't go through another year of this. And if I'm going to be getting torn apart by the likes of John Brown and not the leader of the slave rebellion from back in the day, not by this John Brown, I won't do it. And now when I see him, though, I'm like, oh, okay, you know what? He was actually pretty good, and Bill O'Brien and the Texans got better. It wasn't a 2-14 season.
There were some female situations in my past where I had this desperate love for these people that were not available to me, yet I kept it going and I maintained it. I missed that feeling. Haven't had that feeling in a really long time. Blind, stupid, idiot love.
Really? Yeah, where even though it's a miserable one too, where you're second guessing yourself and wondering all the time.
Well, see, the funny thing was I wasn't second guessing myself.
Oh, okay.
I always assumed it was going to work out. You just need to stick it out. Stick it out. Stick it out. It'll work. You have this. It didn't work. But I went all in. I finally put all my chips on the table at one point, and I don't regret that at all.
Just before we started recording this, the magical thing happened. Adrian Peterson signed by the Washington Redskins. I don't know if you even knew this yet. Adrian Peterson signed by the Washington Redskins. Adrian Peterson, who had one magical game last year when he was first signed by Arizona, got 157 yards rushing versus the San Francisco 49ers. But other than that, and actually including that game, since the beginning of 2016, he's averaged 3 yards per carry. Last year, after he had that 157-yard game, he had three games where he averaged like 2.5 yards per carry. It's been a bad stretch for Adrian Peterson. I don't anticipate him having like a stretch of greatness here with Washington. I suppose maybe if they put in an Adrian Peterson package, which is just all heavy personnel, invite a 9-man box and just scrum it up.
You know, not the worst idea in the world for goal line situations and things like that.
Yeah.
I wonder if he would appreciate being relegated to that, even though he's been out of the league and not looked at the same way that he used to be since probably week 3 of last year with the Saints, where he started really falling out of favor and Alvin Kamara started getting opportunities and really kicking ass.
You know what's strange is that people, no matter how little success he has in each stop along the way, I think there are people out there that think he's not getting opportunities because of the child abuse allegations from a few years back.
Which isn't accurate.
Where he hit his kid with a switch.
Which isn't accurate. I mean, people were willing to overlook
right.
that because...
This is not a Ray Rice situation where
Ray Rice was burnt out.
Right, he was burnt out, but he also, like, he was burnt out. He would have gotten other opportunities, I think. He would have been probably like Adrian Peterson, where he's
situation.
Had a few opportunities if it hadn't been for all of that.
I think the difference between Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson is Adrian Peterson is a physical freak of nature that is seen maybe once in a generation when it comes to running backs. And even where he is now, I mean, that kind of power in short yardage situations, I'm definitely willing to give him like seven carries a game in those spots. And Alex Smith running the bootleg out of a goal line formation with Adrian Peterson in the backfield. I mean, that could work out pretty well for Washington, which I think desperately needs any weapons that they could possibly get
reason,
for Smith.
Because any reason for hope at all.
They're just boring. Bring in Alex Smith. They're just a boring,
these are excuses that we could have made to our fan base, or these are gestures we could have made like even 2 or 3 years ago and it's been viable, but we let Kirk Cousins walk out the door because we weren't quite sure about him, but we're replacing him with another guy that nobody's been sure about for years and years
right.
and years, plus we'll bring in Adrian Peterson. It's depressing. It's depressing if you're a fan
it's
of those teams.
Been depressing for a while for Washington, like the entire Daniel Snyder era. Pretty much my entire lifetime, the Redskins have sucked. And honestly, I mean, 1993, 94, whenever they won their last title, I mean, that was one of the prestige franchises of the league.
The helmet rule has not been popular. It's not been well received. As everybody anticipated, it has not been popular. They have invoked the helmet rule 51 times in 33 preseason games. That's a rate of about 1.5 per game. 43 of those infractions have been on the defense. 8 have actually been on the offense, which surprised me a little bit. I knew there had been a couple on the offense.
Yeah, it's almost 20%.
It seemed like almost nothing. I'm going to say this. 1.5 per game, if they were actually legitimate penalties that you felt like, okay, this guy was lowering his head and using it as a weapon, I feel like I could live with that, and I think that would make a lot of sense. The problem is it's been 1.5 per game. So many of them have been on things that clearly shouldn't have been fouls, and yet at other times during those games, I'm seeing hits that I feel like should be flagged by these new rules, and they're not being flagged. So I know that there's a lot of talk that they're probably going to back this off. Maybe they'll introduce a replay element to it. That's all completely fine. I don't know if at any point I'm going to trust the officials to actually make the calls in the appropriate circumstances.
You can't really trust them to make any call anymore. And it's not entirely their fault. I mean, you got 200 pounds minimum players that are 5'11" to 6'7" on the field. And you're asking these guys over a field that's 120 yards long, 53 and a half yards wide.
Yeah.
And you're asking these guys, four guys, five guys, six guys, to keep an eye on everything. It's tough. So if they add replay, they might be able to do a very good job of keeping tabs on this. But that's going to delay games. And I don't think that the NFL wants to find itself in a similar situation with baseball when it comes to pace of play, or college football, especially when it comes to pace of play, because that's college football's, I think, biggest problem right now. So, these refs, they're in a really bad spot. Is that one and a half calls, is that going to turn away viewers? That's
right.
Really the big question that I have. Because
it's a Trump effect, too, where like one person kneels, Trump tweets about it, and it gets huge and it gets magnified. This gets magnified, not by Trump. I don't think Trump's going to be.
It could be,
actually,
though.
He might be, actually. He'll,
he's
he'll
the
make
one that said football.
It.
Remember when football was
yeah.
tough? When I had the USFL?
He'll make an offhand comment about that at a rally or something. I don't think it's going to be something he really tweets about a lot, because you can get too much traction with the kneeling stuff. But it is that one time that it happens in a game, and then all of a sudden all the old jokes about how it's flag football and they're taking the fun out of football and the violence out of football, they all rear up. So you're right. All it does is take us once to twice a game.
I know.
And it becomes a big deal. And it's one bad call in a weekend, that one gets magnified.
Exactly.
The old catch rule, you know, last year we barely heard about the catch rule until at the end of the season. There was the Jesse James catch in the end zone in the Pittsburgh Steelers game that was a big deal, and it became a big deal again. That's all it takes is one little thing.
You're right.
College has somewhat gotten – are you happy with the way it is in college?
With the targeting?
Other than the fact that they can eject kids without any review. I don't like that at all.
I don't either, because I think that there needs to be clear intent to eject a guy. And
yeah.
And in these calls in the NFL, I feel like there should be intent or something. And I know you brought that up on when we were doing Mad Radio on Tuesday, intent, whether a guy's defenseless or not. And if a guy's actually trying to make a form tackle, like, those are things that they should be looking for. I think that they should be looking for as well specific parts of the helmet that are not areas
like,
that you want to see touching.
If you graze right,
if the crown of the helmet
obviously,
particular.
Yeah. They should have a little chalk ring around it.
You know
so
what?
So, like, in tennis, you can go check the chalk and point to the chalk.
That might be the next the next step is they change helmets in a way where there's a big circle in the middle of it, and it just totally – like ruins the classic look of great helmets across the league.
Should have a big Don Beebe helmet that has sensors in it. Have her running around like Marvin the Martian.
Great kazoo, yeah.
A football field is 53 1/3 yards wide.
Ooh.
53, I said 53 1/2. It's 53 yards and 4 inches, which is weird. And I don't know how that
how did
came
they come
to
up
be.
With that?
I'm going to have to look into that. I remember 53 because I used to run so many half gassers that you know like exactly how far you're going. Half gas, well, full gassers are the most miserable of all things. So that'd be the equivalent of suicides in basketball.
Okay, so you go back and forth. You have to go like a quarter of the way, then halfway and back.
No. That would be a genuine suicide. A gasser is over and back, over and back, and then or you run a half gasser, which is just over and back.
Okay, I think that I might have done those a couple of times in high school, but not to the degree that an NFL player would be doing it.
Any conditioning drill that involves accelerating more than once is the hardest conditioning drill. Like when you have to do shuttles and stuff, when you have to stop and then accelerate, that's hard.
When you were doing those, what was your mentality during those? I remember when I was in high school doing the conditioning drills at the end of practice.
Yeah.
I was like, this is fucking terrible. Let's just get me through this as much as I could. I didn't really see that this actually could be beneficial.
Oh, that
to
it was actually help for you?
Yeah.
I was always Joe Turbo, so my mentality was to win.
Oh, nice.
I was, I just liked winning the conditioning drills. Like, so a lot of, like, seniors hated me when I was a freshman. Because those guys are playing, like, they'd be playing 60 snaps in a game, you know. And you're coming out on Monday, and all you're trying to do is just get through and make it under the time, which is really the way you should do it
right.
On a Monday. It's just for recovery. But I'd be out there just sprinting ahead of everything. I was a little nerd. I was such a little bastard. I talked to one of the guys the other day, Dick Emmett, who was I talked to him on Twitter, not about this, but I'm going to have to apologize to him. He listens to the podcast. Dick, I'm sorry I won all those gassers the days after games during college football. I didn't know how stupid I was and what a Joe Turbo I was. Jim Harbaugh tweeted out, actually, no, it was the Southern accent guy on ESPN.
Oh,
Marty,
yeah.
Marty, whatever.
The NASCAR guy.
Is he the NASCAR guy, but he also does like tailgating type stuff and everything?
His name is Matt.
Marty Smith.
Okay.
Marty Smith. Marty Smith tweeted out this board with motivational sayings that Jim Harbaugh has up on a whiteboard in his office. There are arrows leading from some quotes to others, which seemingly would mean they were related, but I can't figure it out. But there's so many motivational quotes here, and every single one of them is one that, like, I've seen something like in a presentation by a football coach along the way. What were your favorite quotes?
All right, my favorite ones were – number one, and I this was the first one I saw. The smartest person in the room is the one who realizes he or she is not the smartest person in the room. I think you should be as realistic as you possibly can be about yourself, about other people that are around you at all times. I think that sometimes we get a sense of grandeur and a sense of domination or whatever, where we assume that we are at every moment in life the top dog. And, I mean, for example, I feel very confident about what I know about the NFL.
Uh-huh.
I don't feel that confident about what I know about baseball, and I've just decided to go all in on the – I'm just going to pretend like I don't know anything about baseball, except for in specific instances where I want to lay out a hot take of sorts that I actually strongly believe in. And I think it's important to know that in any facet of life, like, there's probably someone, when you're having a conversation with somebody else, that – knows a lot more about what you're talking about
or at the very least exactly what you know, but they have a different perspective on it.
Yeah.
And that's why in politics especially, so much of it comes down to just two really intelligent people can be equally intelligent, but they just have different perspectives on life or different upbringings or different expectations or beliefs, and then they're not going to see eye to eye. That's why the scariest person in the world to me is somebody who's really intelligent who doesn't realize that there are other intelligent people in the world. Like, it's okay to think that you're smarter than most people, because you might in fact be, unless also I'd say this, you're probably really smart in your one facet of life that you're good at, but you might be a complete moron when it comes to talking to your auto mechanic. So quit acting like your excellence in the legal field has anything to do with talking to your auto mechanic, who is much, much smarter than you when it comes to your vehicle.
No, you're 100% right, and I feel for the most part, the person that usually thinks that they are the smartest person in the room is socially an idiot.
Yeah.
You know, that
Trevor Bauer type.
Yeah.
Like Trevor Bauer, the pitcher, who's a really bright guy, but is unbearable amongst his teammates and in life in general, because he doesn't realize that there are other smart people out there, or that other people that like maybe don't understand the math behind what he's doing. But if you just actually have a chat with him, maybe they wouldn't. Maybe they wouldn't hate you so much.
Screw him for that spin rate conversation. That I don't want to hear about any spin rate.
Okay, well, we're stuck on one quote. What's your other favorite quote?
Okay, attack each day with an enthusiasm unknown to mankind.
I'm just sick of that one because I've heard it so much from him and his dad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was the big one when the Ravens went to the Super Bowl. They highlighted his dad a lot. And his dad's an interesting dude. Both the Harbaugh dad was a very Harbaugh-like guy. But I'm just sick of it.
Fair enough. Yeah. I sometimes feel that I approach some days with no enthusiasm, with anger and a cynical loathing of everything. If you are bored, you are boring. I am guilty of that way too much.
Yeah.
For example, on Monday night, while watching the Astros and Mariners in a game that was taking, I felt, far too long because Tony Sipp can't get the fucking ball to home plate, I was getting upset. But should I be saying, oh, I'm bored all the time? No, I shouldn't be. And that's something I'm taking from this, and I'm going to try to apply going forward.
I've used that quote on my daughter. I think it's very effective, but it's not one that I really truly understood until I was maybe like 38 years old. So I don't know if kids necessarily get it. The other thing I think when that comes up is the song by Harvey Danger. It's Flagpole Sitta, where I swear to God, it sounds like they're snoring.
Oh, that one.
But if you're bored, then you're boring. The agony and the irony, something, something, something. That's what comes up.
Don't make someone a priority who treats you like an option. Again, with women, there was one in particular over the past year that I allowed this to manifest.
She treats you like an option?
I mean, doesn't everyone treat everyone like an option these days in the dating world?
I guess it becomes, are you my first option?
It took me a really long time to realize, you know what? I'm probably like option three here.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, you realize, like, you started doing the math.
I was like, all right, how often can you be unavailable?
Like, all of a sudden at the last moment you are available.
Exactly.
Boy, then now I'm getting in my mind a whole matrix of different people with, like, who's option number three. Somebody who's, like, option number three to this other person is talking to that person, but that person's option number one to option number three. But then you go over to you and you're option number two to her, but you're still waiting on the option number one guy. Oh boy, you kids and your dating apps and everything and your texting
ruins everything.
It used to be so hard to get in touch with people and then actually meet up with them that you just didn't have the energy to juggle two people at most. Sometimes people would juggle three, but it was really, really hard. You could conceivably juggle, like, with the proper amount of organization, 10 people?
I had, about a year ago, I had a week where I somehow successfully organized four people.
Oh, God. In a week or a weekend?
In a week. In a weekend, no. It was in a week, and I even felt weird about it afterwards.
Is it kind of taken for granted with people that you're dating now until you, like, actually have the conversation that you're seeing each other exclusively? Does everybody just kind of take it for granted that you're probably seeing other people?
I have been under the assumption of that for a while, and I didn't always feel that way. It's just sort of been a last couple of years. Everything sort of added up to that.
Yeah.
A lot of experiences have been that way.
I mean, Tinder does that.
It does. All of these apps have ruined everything. It makes you look for the next best option. I've been guilty of it myself.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough. It's a tough thing to actually.
It's not in your imagination. It's like right there on the screen.
Yeah, you're like, oh, I'm sure everything. I can find someone else, right? And then you go to the bars and you think the same thing, but then you realize at the bars it's pretty difficult to actually strike up a conversation with someone because you have to get through their social group and you have to actually
have them enjoy you. Is there an app that makes it more like the bar where like you could be on Tinder? And you might swipe, was it swipe right if you like her?
Yes.
You might swipe right on her, but then like three of her friends have to swipe right on you before she even sees that you swiped on her.
That could work. I think that could
work. That might work really well. But then, and then you could see, the beautiful thing would be like, okay, the friends that like maybe, oh, I like this Paul character. Maybe I'll, maybe I won't approve him, but then I'll reach out to him through other means.
I like that.
And then I would blackmail everybody if I owned that. Well, you got any other quotes over there?
I have two that I don't know what the fuck these mean.
Okay.
Okay. Preaching to the choir is for showboats and the soft.
I guess preaching to the choir is if you only seek out people that already agree with you, then what are you doing? You're just looking for self affirmation or confirmation, whatever word it would be.
There's a lot of people on Twitter.
You're right. Yeah, exactly. Like if you're only hanging out with people that agree with you all the time, or you're not trying to like evangelize whatever your message is, then what are you really accomplishing?
Nothing really.
Right. So, but now as a football coach, he'd be the first one to be like, we need to bring in the right kind of guys. Well, why don't you bring in the wrong kind of guys and preach to them?
Yeah, exactly. Turn them.
Yeah, hypocritical bastard.
The last one that I just said to myself, lead like Truman, don't tap dance like Fred Astaire. Okay, so Harry as Truman, he dropped nuclear weapons on Japan.
Right.
He did lead.
Well, I mean, he led.
He made a tough decision.
He inherited the job from a dead president, and then he did have to make that decision. Now,
but how does Fred Astaire relate to this?
What was the Fred Astaire part?
Don't tap dance like Fred Astaire. How did we get from Harry S. Truman?
Was Fred Astaire a bad tap dancer?
I think he was a really good one.
I know
one.
He's a good dancer.
Right?
But don't – yeah, why are we throwing Fred Astaire under
exactly.
the bus for no good reason?
Exactly. I don't understand
that. Was he like – did they find out he was an anti-Semite later on or something? Like Fred Astaire? They found out he was a commie and an anti-Semite.
And anti-nuclear weapons.
It came out with the McCarthyism. Truman, this is a delicate situation. Truman ordered the bombing of Hiroshima. I just learned something about the Nagasaki and whether he – don't quote me any of this. I'll read it and we'll update everybody else next. But like they didn't tell. Oh, this is what it was. I don't think that Truman was actually informed of the true devastation of Hiroshima at the time that he ordered the second bomb dropped.
Oh,
or something like that, because Truman had just stepped in. And Roosevelt, like relatively recently, you know, Roosevelt obviously had the advisors he could trust and everything. But there's a little bit of an image of Truman kind of being led around by the generals who, look, you give a general a bomb, he's going to use it. The president's supposed to be the gatekeeper between
that. Especially then, I mean, we like to think that the presidents have all of the power, but yeah. I imagine the president then versus the president now, there's a big discrepancy in the actual power that they had. And then,
well, yeah, because FDR changed the presidency a lot in terms of exactly what his powers were.
And I took a class at Syracuse. I took political science as a minor, and one of the classes I took was about like military and the relationship with the government and all of that, and just talked about coups and stuff all the time.
Yeah,
the government and the military are almost always adversarial, because the government, they have to allocate resources, they have to determine, all right, what amount of money,
and
what amount
to,
of troops get put in, and the
they
generals
have to please many masters as
right,
well.
Exactly, so because they're pleasing people that are outside of the military sector.
Yeah,
where everyone in the military is like, we need this. Give it to us.
And this is what we have an objective. We want to go do it. And this is how we're going to do
exactly.
it. And we don't want to think about anything else. This is what we got to do.
So they probably thought to themselves in that moment, well, we can take advantage of this and we can do things the way that we want to do them.
But now think about in the military, too. They're facing all these POWs in Japan are being treated miserably.
Yeah.
The percentage of American POWs that died in prison camps in Japan compared to the other theater of the war was ridiculous. Like the Japanese prison camps were just horrendous, just horrendous circumstances. And Japan had the plan at the time that if it looked like it, they got to the point of no return, they were going to kill all the POWs. Like, the Japan had this no-surrender policy that they were going to go down fighting no matter what. So, and now we get into, okay, does that justify the nuclear bomb or what have you? But I could see from the military perspective and from the general's perspectives, you've got how many untold other soldiers are going to die trying to invade Japan where they have this no surrender policy. All the POWs are going to get killed as soon as we land.
Yeah.
So what do we do? It was kind of tense. And let's remember that when we talk about how much mean people are mean to each other on Twitter, it's not actually all that bad.
It's not all that bad
compared to what things used to be.
No, not at all. I mean, again, they had to end the war. That's what, and honestly, you take a look there. I read some long report about what would have happened if they had invaded, and Jesus,
it would have been crazy.
And you know what? Shit, my grandfather, both my grandfathers fought in each theater. My dad's dad fought in the South Pacific. I mean, they would have had to pull a lot of resources into Japan to actually accomplish whatever objective they would have wanted to, and it would have taken a lot of manpower considering how determined they were to win or die at all costs. Dan Carlin has a podcast, by the way, Hardcore History, and he just started. It's like the beginning of like why Japan became what it was in World War II. The first part was out, came out like a couple of weeks ago. Very good.
Well, the whole – and I was trying to explain this to my daughter as she was it was one of these things where your kids ask you a history question and you realize you don't know enough about it. But thus that whole concept among nations that existed for however many hundreds of years where it was just kind of like you want to be an empire, right? Of course I want to be an empire. And it was just kind of accepted like, there goes Germany off trying to be an empire. Let's see what happens later on. No big deal. Japan, what are they? They're trying to be an empire. Where somehow they finally figured out after how many centuries of civilization, all right, let's cool it with the empire building. Well, just all it took was a couple of world wars with millions and millions of people
dying. No big deal.
You found this as you were perusing Canadian medical journals, as I know you want to do.
There's a website that I go to.
You don't have to cite the website because they're from a competitor of mine.
I won't.
I'm going to say this about your generation, and including people like that, people in the media from your generation. You guys think that you need to credit aggregators when no, all you need to do is credit the original source.
Fair enough.
So the Canadian study, this is a Canadian study. Like, I don't have to – Mike sometimes, it'll drive me crazy. Mike will credit Pro Football Talk for some report. I'm like, no. But no, Mike Florio took that from this other source. You credit the actual
source. Fair
enough.
In defense of this story, though, it basically was a long list
of
all the stuff that happens in a pool.
Yeah.
And he was going from all sorts of different sources.
All right. Okay, what was the website? You can say the website.
It was through Dollar Shave Club, which is...
That was the website, dollarshaveclub.com.
They put a lot of content up about like random things that a guy might think of.
I was just being finicky because I myself am a Harry's Razor fellow.
Right, exactly.
I'm a Harry's Razor man.
Oh, I didn't have to say the website.
No, but now it's an interesting conversation. We don't have to cite that website, but if that's the way it was, then there you go.
So a pool, there's typically an average of 8 gallons of pee in a typical 110,000-gallon pool. And that's really not much at all.
It honestly doesn't sound that bad.
It doesn't because it's dispersed.
Except that it's 8 gallons.
It's still 8 gallons. And so to get to 8 gallons, apparently the human bladder contains an average of 300 milliliters or so of urine. And that adds up to get to 8 gallons, it's about 100 people going to the bathroom when they're in there. I feel like that number...
That seems actually small, too.
It seems small. So apparently, 100 people are pissing in the pool at any moment. And the problem is, water does not get changed very often in a pool. It's the same water.
Yeah.
So you can put chlorine, you can put all sorts of stuff in it.
Over time, though, that urine's accumulating.
It accumulates.
All right. So it seems like it would be more than 8 gallons
after And you mix it with chemicals.
Yeah.
I think it's per year. It's 8 gallons per year. In a 110,000-gallon pool. And unless these pools are getting drained on the regular, which, again, is expensive because water costs so much.
Up north, outdoor pools get drained every year at least. Where down south, it's just that same water staying in there.
I'd imagine all year long. Yeah. Maybe they drain it a couple of times. And apparently, if you smell chlorine in a pool, you might think, that means it's clean. No, that's actually a gas that's created when chlorine reacts with chemicals in your urine. And the stronger the chlorine smell, the more pee is likely in the pool. Yeah, I know.
And it might not even actually be all that clean. Like, you smell it, and you're like, oh, that's a lot of chlorine. At least it'll keep me clean. But no, it might actually be just urine.
This is why I find it disgusting when people pee in the pool. I think it's disgusting.
I don't go for it either.
I think in the ocean, you can get away with it.
Uh-huh.
I think in a lake you can get away with it. But if I'm in a pool, I am getting out of the pool and I'm going to the bathroom outside of the pool.
I used to have a friend named Brian Lopez. We'd go fishing. We'd go and we'd rent a boat, like when we were in high school. Go rent a little boat with an outboard engine, like a hand-steered outboard engine and everything. And he would always, like every single time we went, because it would be in the afternoon, I guess that was when his body would tell him it's time to go, he'd jump over the edge and just drop a deuce in the lake, in Canandaigua Lake. And I for the life of me, I don't think I could do it. But that's what he would do routinely. And it's a really big lake, and it was usually like, it wasn't in the summer, it wasn't during the swimming time of year. Is that acceptable to actually poop in a lake?
I mean,
I guess you would do that.
There's no salt in it, right? It's a freshwater lake.
It's a freshwater lake.
Well, I suppose you're contributing to the circle of life, right? I imagine the fishies are going to eat that.
Yeah, they'll
dispose of it really quickly.
Nobody's a very little chance that somebody, but it might float up on somebody's dock or something.
Yeah, that's true.
I guess.
That's true.
Which already has a bunch of bird poop on it.
A little fertilizer.
It's human poop.
A little fertilizer for the flies or something like that. Look, I would advise against it, but. Look, when duty calls, I suppose if you're out in the middle of a lake, where are you going to go?
All right, good. I'm glad we finished on this. This is socially important stuff. We finally got to that.
By the way, so I floated the river in Austin on a bachelor party last week.
Yeah.
Guess how many condoms I saw floating in the river?
Oh,
three.
You counted three?
Three. And one of them I almost touched. One of them I almost
People
touched.
People doing at that moment, like finally at the end, you're like, ah, I'm going to finish this off with a cigarette and polluting Mother Nature. The hell, pull out, kids.
Right, know what? If you're gonna go, like honestly, you're probably better off just going unprotected in the river, right?
That's
wrong.
That's a Don Draper move, right there. Thanks, Paul.
You're welcome for that.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us, and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.